From WHYY in Philadelphia, this is Fresh Air Weekend. I'm Dave Davies in for Terry Gross.
I've got nothing. I'm a 52-year-old man, no wife, no kids. I have my second chance. I had it.
In this season of comic Mark Maron's series Maron, his character has become addicted to Oxy, squandered his success, and entered rehab. Today, Maron talks about his own experiences with rehab. Life is going well for him now, and he doesn't know how to handle it.
You know, I feel myself doing things instinctively to make myself uncomfortable. Like I'm overeating, you know, I'm judging myself harshly. And it's something, well, not unlike addiction, that, you know, my comfort zone is uncomfortable. And it has been my entire life.
Also, Rabbi Susan Silverman talks about her mission in life, international adoption. Two of her five children are adopted from Ethiopia.
Little girls sometimes would write, like, about who they're going to marry. I would write lists of kids' names.
First news. This is Fresh Air Weekend. I'm Dave Davies in for Terry Gross.
All right, everybody. Before we get to today's interview, I think it's time to address the pink elephant in the room.
That's comic and podcaster Mark Maron playing a fictionalized version of himself in the first episode of the new season of his IFC series, Maron. The elephant in the room his character is referring to is his addiction to Oxy, the opioid pain medication which he started taking last season for back pain. Because of the addiction, he's lost everything. He could no longer afford his home, so he's living in a storage unit, and he hasn't done his podcast in over a year. In that clip, he's actually just talking into a cell phone, alone in his storage unit. Eventually, his friends stage an intervention, and Maron goes to rehab, and the season unfolds from there. The real Mark Maron is famous for his autobiographical confessional comedy and for his podcast, WTF, in which he talks about his life and interviews a guest comic, actor, or musician. Let's hear a scene from the first episode of this season of Maron. Maron goes to a bar to find two old friends who are also comics, Dave Anthony and Andy Kindler. He wants to get Louis C.K.'s phone number from them so he can convince Louis to do an interview that will help him revive his podcast. But Mark is still addicted to Oxy, and his friends have had it with him. Mark speaks first.
Long time.
Not long enough.
Andy. Hey, have you been, Mark? I asked that rhetorically because I know you haven't been doing well.
It's all right. How are my cats doing?
Monkey is mean and LaFonda is terrifying.
Yeah, I know, right? Sometimes?
Yeah.
I miss them. Thanks for watching them for me.
So, why are you here? You done destroying your life yet?
No, not yet. It's a work in progress. But thanks for asking.
Where are you living? You got a place?
Yeah, I'm in a studio apartment situation.
I heard it was like a storage unit. Is
that multi-purpose, right? It's like an artist colony, okay? Look, I'm trying to get hold of Louie, all right? I'm trying to get hold of him, but I think I have an old phone number or something. Can you guys just give me his new number? Can you just... Come on, man, it's for my career.
You know, I don't know. I'd have to check with him first.
This is bullshit, man.
No, Mark. You know what's bullshit? Is you getting hooked on drugs and then burning your friends over and over and over.
Yeah, well, you too.
Okay, that's a scene from the opening episode of this season of Maron. Mark Maron, welcome back to Fresh Air. Great to talk with you again.
So nice to talk to you, Terry.
I have to tell you, I found the opening episode very upsetting. Just like seeing you so strung out and seeing how your personality is changed by the drugs and the desperation to get more money to buy more drugs. And I know that there was a period in your past where you had drug problems and that you've been, you know, sober for a long time. And in showing us this version of you, it's like, oh, it was just upsetting to me to see you that way, because I kind of come on board in your career and certainly in interviewing you once you're sober. So what was it like for you to go back to that? To that version of yourself, which I assume is what you drew on.
Well, at the time that I was having drug problems, I did not have that much to lose. And I was a little more managing of the issues than the character in the show. And I was a younger man. So I did not get as far down as this character did. But my first experience with the rehab and with having that that happen in my life, I remember it, and I certainly did not approach it the same way this guy would. Like, I see a lot of people being in recovery. You do see people relapse with long-term sobriety, and it's horrifying. So what I did with this was I just really played it as straight as I could and really felt what I thought would be what one would feel. There's a certain denial that comes over you when you are in a relationship with drugs, where you justify that things really aren't as bad as they appear. That I'm living in a storage unit, and somehow the way I played it was because of the drugs. There was part of me that had to think that I was, you know, still keeping it together, and I think that's a very real thing that happens when you get that strung out.
But did you find yourself like drawing on mannerisms that you remembered from when you were using drugs, or you know, ways you'd express anger or frustration?
Sure. But I think they were more, when I used drugs, I was younger, it was mostly weed and coke and booze. And, you know, I'd sort of mix it up. I was never really an opiates guy.
So was it at all kind of frightening to go to this place where the character who's based on you has been, you know, sober for 16 years, and now he's kind of addicted to painkillers? I mean, the thought of losing that sobriety must be pretty scary. And you had to put yourself in that position to play the character.
It's horrifying. It's horrifying. It's one of the, it is really the essence of what keeps me sober in some respects. There, you have to have a very real terror and fear of drugs and alcohol on some level to stay sober. I think that the core of it is really knowing in your heart and in your mind that you cannot use those things, you know, safely or with any control whatsoever. And that's buried pretty deep in my mind. But again, I've seen what happened in the show happen to people. And coming out of the last season, it was sort of an epiphany to do this season like this. It wasn't planned at the end of last season when I relapsed on drugs. But I think for me, it's a cautionary tale.
I just want to keep saying your character relapsed on drugs. You didn't.
I did not.
The people tuning in the middle of this, yeah.
Some people were very concerned about it because the first three seasons were so tied to my life. And then at the end of season three, you know, I get a back injury and then I slip on drugs. And that is what happens. So exploring this for me was really, I don't know if cautionary tale is the right word for it, but it was something. This season is actually more real emotionally, I think, than the seasons that were based on my actual life, because I was able to explore the possibility of this thing with some knowledge of what would happen and what life would look like, and also that by humbling me like this in this season and making me, it's humiliating and it's embarrassing, and I've got nothing to lose anymore, and I've got nothing literally. It was really interesting for me as an actor to work from that place, because I'm not really an actor, and I think I've gotten better over the seasons, but this was really challenging, and it was this completely fictional landscape that is a very real problem and a very real fear of mine. So it was exciting and sad, but like, I'm glad it happened in a fiction and not in real life. You know what I'm saying, Terry?
I know what you're saying, Mark. So what point was your career at when you started doing drugs?
I believe. Well, I
when was, you started doing drugs and it became a problem because you.
Oh, it was it was a sad time. You know, like the first time I got sober was 1987, 88-ish. It was 88, and you know, I'd been in Hollywood as a 23-year-old, and I got really out of control on coke, and I went back home to I was in Hollywood for a year, and I went back home to New Mexico, and I got sober that first time in an actual rehab. And then, like, I was sort of in and out for years. You know, it took me, like, 24, 25 years to get the 16 in a row that I have because I never really locked in. But the last bottom, I guess, I hit, the real one was, you know, I was in an awkward marriage. You know, I was using cocaine and drinking behind my wife's back, and I would go on the road, and it was getting ugly. And I really just was laying in bed, you know, next to a sleeping woman, with my heart pounding, just really, you know, wanting to die. And my career was, you know, I'd surrendered to the idea that I was not going to be a big comic. I was not going to have a TV career. I was doing segments for a regional show in New York on something called the Metro Channel. And I'd really sort of resigned myself to failure and to hopelessness. And then, so that was like, when would that have been? 98, 99? I think I got, you know, I'm coming up on 17 years. So, you know, I met somebody, a woman who just happened to be beautiful and stunning and sober and a fan who, you know, kind of reached out and said, you know, I can get you to meetings. I can get you help. And, you know, and I don't know if I really wanted to get sober, but I wanted to be with her. So it worked out, kind of.
So I want to play another scene from this season, and this is in the second episode. You're in rehab now. There's been an intervention. You're in rehab. You've just gone through detox, so the drugs are out of your system, and you're having your first meeting with the sobriety counselor. You're in the counselor's office. You're wearing a hospital gown, and the counselor, played by Craig Anton, speaks first.
Okay, here's your stuff. Better luggage than I had when I came in here. All my clothes were packed into small 7-Eleven bags. Look at me now, though. So nothing changes if nothing changes, right?
Yeah, I guess. Can we just get through this? I'm a little wiped out.
I get it. You're embarrassed. You feel like crap. So was everyone else who sat in that chair. Everyone here has been where you are, or worse. Before I came here, my situation was dark, real dark.
Really?
Oh, yeah. I used to live with my mom, man, on her couch. Grown man, living on his mom's couch, drinking every day, watching cartoons. Some dark, dark times.
Wow. I had no idea it was possible to be an addict and to be really boring.
Sure. Start attacking. Do whatever you can to avoid your feelings. But feelings are not facts, Mark.
Jesus, I'm not avoiding my feelings. I'm tired. I just detoxed. I want to lay down.
Okay, I'm going to give you some stuff to read. Look, you may think this is the worst day of your life, but it's actually the best day of your life.
Look, I'm not some 20-year-old, okay? I've been through this before. I know all the sayings.
Okay, so cards on the table. I know more about you than my usual patient. I followed your stand-up. I listened to your podcast, so I know you.
Why would you tell me that?
Because the honesty in your podcasting, I think it's important. And I think it'd be helpful to show the podcasting world that you're sober and back.
No, no, man.
Talking about it is a big part of sobriety. You know that. Let it out.
I'm not doing my podcast.
Oh, no, that's not what I meant. I do a recovery podcast. It's called Let Go and Let Pod. I would love to have you on as a guest. It's a good time to talk.
Yeah, and a bad time to be stupid. I want to go. Can you tell me my room number?
9.
You're not going to tell me?
It's room 9.
This scene from Marc Maron's series, Maron. Let Go and Let Pod has to be one of the worst titles ever. I love that you came up with that.
We were so excited about that dumb 9 joke. He would speak German for a
right,
second.
Right, yeah.
It's
very Mel Brooks.
It just came up on this set. Michael Jammin came up with it, and we could not stop laughing about it. It was one of those jokes where he just, you know, thought of it on the spot, not even to put in the show, just because that's the way his brain works. It's a very quick kind of a Mel Brooksy type of joke, and I was like, let's just do it. We're having so many laughs. We did the joke like 3 or 4 times, and everybody cracked up the same every time. We're like, let's just put it in.
So there's all these kind of sayings that the counselor has, like nothing changes if nothing changes. Feelings are not facts. You may think this is the worst day of your life, but it's really the best day of your life. And the funny thing about all those statements is like there's embedded in that all those horrible cliches are actual truths.
Absolutely. Yeah. So,
can you talk a little bit about what it's been like for you in the past in rehab to, as somebody who's kind of like allergic to cliche, what it was like for you to get like these truths that come packaged in these like horrible cliches?
Well, it took a long time for me, even to sort of engage with the structure of the program. And, and it's a little dicey dealing with the program publicly because there is, part of the traditions of the program that say that you shouldn't deal with it publicly. But it was my belief that if it was handled with some subtlety and with some respect, that it would not be demeaning to the program and it would actually raise awareness. I'll get around to what you're asking me, but, we didn't really take into consideration too deeply the fact that there is a horrendous opioid epidemic going on with addiction to these things. So it was just sort of some sort of weird coincidence that this was the narrative of the show. So I really wanted to make sure that the way we captured this thing, even in all its seeming not like there is something hackneyed about those adages. But when you're new in sobriety, eventually one or two of them will stick and actually become helpful. That's the odd thing about those silly sayings is that he's reeling many of them off. But in my early sobriety, once you sort of understand these things, they're very small packages that can reveal fairly large habits and thoughts that could help you. And however anyone takes this in, how I captured rehab in that experience. I've already gotten a lot of emails from people who are either in the program or need the program that really kind of responded in a positive way to it. The adages and the little sayings were just the repetition of them. I think we exaggerated a bit, but it's certainly a reality. And I do think that some of them, they help you. They actually help you. That like I make fun of it, but eventually, a couple of them will stick with you, and you hate saying them, and you hate hearing them said, but the ideas behind them are solid.
Would it be crossing a line to ask which ones worked for you?
No. The classic one is sort of is one day at a time, which, as trite as it may seem, is a very powerful idea if you tend to be filled with panic and dread and you're projecting a future that is horrible, or you don't understand how you're gonna stay sober in a week or 2 weeks or a year or anything else, to really somehow pound it into your head that all you have is today, and that one day at a time business is a very sound philosophical and practical way to look at life, because it keeps you in the present, not so horrible. First things first is another one that really is about, putting your sobriety before anything else, because everything else will follow if you can sort of keep a priority around staying clean. I mean, there is sort of a genius to the simplicity of it all, because it is designed to work for really anybody that is capable of cognitive thinking.
Were you in a program that emphasized a higher power, and did that work
sure.
for you?
Well, yeah. I mean, the higher power is part of it, but the genius of it is that it's of your own decision, of your own understanding, and that's a lot of leeway, Terry.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So how you behave spiritually is really up to you. I personally, and this is where it gets a little tricky in being publicly sober, is like I am no spokesman for the program, I'm only affiliated in that it helped me get sober and continues to, but it's really of your own decision.
So can I ask you what you used as a higher power, or were you
Sure. I mean, like, for me, like, really, it was really, there's another cute saying that I heard in the rooms that is not a program saying, but it was, God doesn't wake up and think he's you. So, you know, like, so, like, it was more humor for me than anything else. And, you know, certainly the group itself or the program itself can function as a higher power. And then just sort of like, you know, understanding some kind of, you know, universal order that you know, that I do have faith in people and I have faith that things are going to keep going. I am very vague about a sense of God actively in my life. You know, I have at different points in my life prayed, certainly at the beginning of my sobriety, you know, that it was recommended that you get on your knees and pray to something. And I did that because I found that the act of humbling yourself, there was something very emotional about the act of praying. Whether or not I believed or not didn't seem to really matter. And I sort of keep it vague like that. I don't have a relationship with a higher power or a God, but I do know it's not me.
Right. So, on the whole, it sounds like things have been going pretty well for you. You know, the podcast is going really well. You have your series on IFC. You're still doing stand-up comedy. On a recent episode of your podcast, you were nearly apologizing to your audience about how well things were going. And you were talking about how Lin-Manuel Miranda gave you a shout-out when he was exiting the stage of Hamilton. Lorne Michaels came to see you in the green room when you were doing The Tonight Show and sat there and schmoozed with you a while. Do you worry that, like, your persona and your comedy would have to change if you allowed yourself to experience happiness or enjoy success?
I wish I had that much control over it. I worry about, like, I don't really know how to handle being okay. You spend a lifetime struggling to get someplace, and then you find your little place, and, you know, things are going well. But my concern is that, not that my persona will change or that I have to do that, but I think I'd like to, but I don't know how, Terry. I don't, like, this is a very, you know, impending or whatever. It's a very immediate problem. Like this morning, last night, you know, I got to write new comedy, and, you know, I feel myself doing things instinctively to make myself uncomfortable. Like I'm overeating, you know, I'm judging myself harshly. Like it's almost like I have to write this new comedy. So I'm figuring out how do I get myself into some chaos, into some self-hatred. Like, but I'm not consciously doing that. It's just happening and I'm watching the pattern and I'm fighting it. I'm like, there's got to be a place for me to come from with an open heart and with a certain amount of success and a certain amount of peace of mind. I'm wary to say happiness, but then all of a sudden, you know, how relatable are you really? Like, hey, things are going really great, but I'm still kind of sad. I mean, who the hell wants to hear that for an hour, you know? So, you know, I don't want to be one of those people that, you know, holds on to the things that make me feel, you know, bad about myself in order to keep moving forward. But it seems to happen surprisingly instinctively. Like all those people that, you know, that judge, you know, people or just self-destructive artists as maintaining that lifestyle in order to be creative. Like I never really bought that until I realized that it's not something you maintain out of choice. It's something that actually happens inside of you, a pattern, an emotional pattern that runs deeper than your consciousness, that, you know, that becomes what you have to fight if you choose to fight it. So that awareness might yield something funny, but I'm happy to say that I was right, that it's not a choice to maintain, but it's something, well, not unlike addiction, that, you know, my comfort zone is uncomfortable. And I it has been my entire life, that being sort of anxious and uncomfortable has really been my home base innately. And I don't know how to change that. And that's really the challenge for me now, because some part of me wants to appreciate and find some joy and some happiness in life, because I'm told it doesn't last forever.
What, life or joy or both?
Life, both.
Okay. It's terrific to talk with you again, and I hope you do end up doing another season. No pressure. Thanks.
Thanks, Terry.
Thanks for coming back.
I love talking to you.
I love talking with you.
Mark Maron spoke with Terry last Tuesday. His comedy series, Maron, is on the IFC cable channel. I feel like you're going to be interested in this next commentary. It's about the expression, I feel like. A lot of young people, and some others, often start their sentences that way. But some people hear that expression as a way of avoiding taking a stand. Not so, says our linguist Jeff Nunberg. He believes it's just another case of one generation misunderstanding the other.
The way kids speak today, I'm here to tell you. Over the course of history, every aging generation has made that complaint, and it's always turned out to be overblown. That's just as well. If the language really had been deteriorating all this time, we'd all be grunting like bears by now. But when it comes to language, history is bunk. Or anyway, it hasn't deterred critics from monitoring the speech of today's young people for the signs of cultural decline. In fact, it was a professor of history named Molly Worthen who raised an alarm in the New York Times recently about the way millennials start their sentences with, "I feel like," as in, "I feel like the media should concentrate more on the issues." That expression may sound merely diffident, Worthen says, but its real purpose is to avoid confrontation by turning every statement into a feeling that halts an argument in its tracks. How can you say that my experience isn't valid? In the end, she says, "I feel like" makes logical discussion impossible and undermines the conduct of public life. That's an awful lot to heap on the meaning of a little colloquialism, particularly when it actually doesn't mean that at all. "I feel like" is just a recent addition to the qualifiers we use to hedge our statements so we don't go around sounding like dogmatic jerks. Phrases like "I think," "I suppose," and "I guess." When we use verbs that way, their literal meanings are diluted. "I suspect he's already left" isn't like "I suspect he's been stealing from me." "I guess I'll have the steak" — that's not a guess, it's just how you announce that you've come to a decision. And however "I feel like" strikes you at first, it's not just about feelings, it's a way of introducing an opinion. I was talking with my students about online advertising the other day, and one of them said, "I feel like you shouldn't have to see ads with paid content." He wasn't saying, "That's my personal experience and I defy you to contradict it." He was just stating his view, and he was open to debating the point. If you actually go on Twitter and look at how people use the phrase, it usually means pretty much the same as "to my mind" or "if you ask me." "I feel like the Apple Watch should include a dock charger." "I feel like the Giants have to fix the bottom of their rotation." You have to be doggedly obtuse to hear those uses of "feel" as pure effusions of feeling, much less to take them as evidence that millennials have all bailed on the sturdy rationalism of the Gen Xers and boomers and given themselves over to rampant subjectivity. Young people are perfectly capable of articulating logical opinions, whether about baseball or the political process. They just introduce them differently. But then, these lamentations are always obtuse. The complaints about "I feel like" are no more off the wall than the complaints people make about texting abbreviations, vocal fry, or the other features that make the language of the young sound weird to older ears. Critics always want to make the next generation seem more alien than it actually is, like anthropologists reporting back from a field trip to Youngster Island. But the point of these Jeremiads isn't to understand the language or manners of the younger generation. It's to assuage the narcissistic injuries of the generations that are being pushed aside. Linguistically speaking, the hippies were right about people over 30. That's when our ear for language begins to fail us. It gets harder to learn new languages or memorize poetry. We forget more old words than we learn new ones. And we're apt to misunderstand what young people are trying to say. We register the words and tones, but we can't imagine our way into their meanings. All we can do is project, coloring their words with our associations. That response is automatic, almost neuronal. It doesn't help if we know better. We hear young people use the rising intonation called uptalk, and we invest it with the uncertainty that that intonation signals in our own speech. Or anyway, I do, even though I'm aware it doesn't mean that to them. We hear "I feel like" and we flash on psychotherapy and encounter groups and blame it on polarization or postmodern relativism, things that matter more to us than they do at the high school lunch tables where these expressions got their start in life. Projection again. It's natural to try to blame our difficulties on them. If they really cared about communicating with us, they'd use words the same way we do. Well, it's unsettling to hear the language changing. You feel like things are slipping away from you, like the conversation is moving elsewhere, which of course it really is. You feel a sense of displacement and cultural dispossession. You wish you could somehow roll it all back. It's a feeling that's in the air these days. It ought to come with a cap that says, make the English language great again.
Jeff Nunberg is a linguist who teaches at the University of California, Berkeley School of Information. Maybe you've heard the irreverent comic Sarah Silverman mention that one of her older sisters is a rabbi who lives in Israel. People are usually surprised to hear that. That sister, Susan Silverman, is our guest. She's written a new memoir about the family she grew up in and the family she created. When she was young, her infant brother died in his crib. She writes, "The shape of my life formed itself around ragged fears of death. It demanded vigilance." She now has 5 children, 3 birth daughters, and 2 sons she and her husband adopted from Ethiopia. She considers adoption her mission, and she started an organization called Second Nurture to promote a culture of adoption and give homes and families to children who have none. She's also on the board of the group Women of the Wall, whose mission is to allow women to wear prayer shawls, pray out loud, and read from the Torah at the Western Wall, also known as the Wailing Wall, in Jerusalem. She spoke with Terry last Monday.
Susan Silverman, welcome to Fresh Air. Now, since your sister Sarah has been on the show several times, I have to start by asking you, did having Sarah as a younger sister contribute to you wanting to have 5 children of your own?
You know, it's funny because for the first few years of being a parent, and even occasionally till today, I call my oldest daughter Sarah because she was my baby. We're 7 years apart. And to this day, I'll sometimes look at Aliza, our oldest, and say, Sarah, Aliza, you know. Yeah, I think it did because she was just delicious, a delicious little one.
So we can't talk about your mission in life, adoption, without talking about your infant brother who died, because I'm sure there's a profound connection there someplace. So the story is when you were, I think, 2 years old, and your brother Jeffrey was an infant, your parents went on a cruise, and that's a complicated story. Your mother was a contestant on the game show Concentration, and she won all these things, which I think they sold because they needed the money. Your parents sold them, but they kept the cruise. The cruise was about to expire, so they had to use it or lose it. And Jeffrey was an infant, but, you know, 2 sets of grandparents. One of the maternal grandparents took you. The paternal grandparents took Jeffrey, the infant, while your parents went on the cruise. Why don't you describe what happened?
So they returned from the cruise, and they arrived in New York, and they were going to spend the weekend at the World's Fair. And before they sort of went off to, you know, the various World Fair activities, they called in and just to check on the kids. And my grandfather's best friend answered and said, "Donnie, Jeffrey's gone." And my father thought Jeffrey had been kidnapped, like the Lindbergh baby, and said, "What? Gone? What does that mean?" And they found out that the fluke accident in the crib had broken and had killed him.
It strangled him.
Yeah.
So you were 2. What was your understanding of what had happened?
I don't remember it. It took me many years to understand that there was even any significance to that in my life, because I thought I was 2. He was an infant. I didn't know him. I don't remember it. And it wasn't until, you know, being in therapy after college that the therapist, I didn't even mention it to her, seeing her for like 2 years or 3 years. And finally, when it came up, she said, "Wait, what? You have all this separation anxiety, you have all this fear that people you love are going to die, and you didn't think to mention that you had an infant brother that died?" And I was like, he was a baby. I was 2. And she said, "No, when you're that age, that kind of loss just becomes part of your DNA. It just becomes part of who you are." And as soon as she named it for me, I mean, it certainly didn't go away. You know, I mean, the phone rings and I'm sure that, you know, it's something horrible happened to somebody. You know, my father has the same thing. We answer the phone saying, "Is everyone okay?" Instead of hello. But it a big part of that heaviness, I actually saw it like fly away in that office on that day. Just naming it was huge.
Well, you mentioned separation anxiety. You had a really bad case of it as a child. You were afraid to let your mother out of your sight. You were afraid she was going to die. How did you how did that kind of hypervigilance and fear express itself in your life?
It was a constant battle to be able to live my life without the people I loved in my sight. and the anxiety, even sometimes, even at school, as a kid through, maybe not through high school, but into high school, I would feel I'd need to be able to check in. I would need to be able to know that everyone was okay. There was such anxiety the whole day. I was so distracted by the possibilities of people dying that it was hard to focus on whatever, just be in it. I would look at other kids who are laughing, having lunch, doing their thing. I think, how can they be so carefree? How can they not be worried right now?
So your parents would not entertain any thought of God, total atheists. Mm-hmm. You would make deals with God.
Mm-hmm.
And then you became a rabbi. I mean, you got real about it.
Yeah.
And your parents had tried to open the door to religion after your infant brother Jeffrey died. It didn't stick for them. I mean, they weren't finding the meaning and the solace that they were looking for. So they abandoned that brief flirtation with being a practicing Jew. What walked you to the door of being a practicing Jew and then becoming a rabbi, going all the way?
Well, right. I'm not sure that actually they even flirted with it, really. They were handed stuff after his death by the rabbi. You go through the motions of having a funeral.
Right.
He hands you stuff and they sort of stood there looking at it like, what are we supposed to do? The truth is that I think there were a few strands that sort of came together. One was Yosef, who is then my boyfriend, now my husband, was living in Israel. And I wanted to find something to do for a year and live there with him. And I thought it would be really funny if what I did was a first year of rabbinical school, because that's crazy.
You thought it would be funny?
Yeah,
I
thought it would be funny. I mean, listen, I wanted to learn some Jewish stuff. I wanted to be in Israel near him. And there were lots of like year programs where you can study here, study there, volunteer here. And I just thought, what if my year of study was actually in a rabbinical program? Like, that's crazy. But also, it's not just that. Also, I had met Yosef and he was like me in a million ways, like liberal, activist, cared about issues. But when I talked about, we met in the anti-apartheid movement at BU. And when I talked about the issue about apartheid and about divestment, I could say things like racism is bad, oppression is bad. But he had this eternal language. He would say that everyone's made Tzelem Elohim, in the image of God. And I thought, wow, these like eternal concepts that someday if I have kids and I can teach them these eternal concepts that they can then apply as needed, right, in their lives. It's not just racism is bad. It's that there's this essential truth that can guide them. And I sort of fell for him and fell for Judaism, but I didn't know anything really about it. So those things sort of came together and I thought, I probably won't really finish rabbinical school, but I'll go there. I'll learn. This is such a crazy idea. Why not? And it just grew on me.
What about your fear that people who you loved would die? By this time, you're an adult. You're not a child. But embracing religion and studying to be a rabbi, did that ease any of your suffering in constantly predicting people's death and constantly imagining the death of everybody you loved?
Becoming more Jewishly engaged gave me some really meaningful metaphors and stories that I could use and, replace anxieties with those. I mean, imperfectly. This is a song that I learned early on that, kids who grow up in Jewish contexts learn like in kindergarten, but I learned it as an adult. And it's, the whole world is a very narrow bridge, but the important thing is not to be afraid. And that was really helpful to me. And I used to joke to Yosef that like, I wish that that was the soundtrack that played in my head growing up instead of like, Help Me, Rhonda. And so these metaphors were very helpful. It's about risk. It's about an uncertain world. It's about having a vision despite it all. And that was very helpful. And so was Zoloft.
Okay, so let's continue your story. You got married to your boyfriend, Yosef, who is your husband. And I should say, before you were married, you were pregnant. You, the rabbinical student. And before you knew you were pregnant, you were saying to Yosef, like, we have to adopt. Like, let's file now before we're even married. Mm-hmm. You knew you wanted to have children. You knew you wanted to also adopt children. Why was this a calling of yours to have, five was your goal, five children. Why was having such a relatively large family so important to you?
When they're like little girls sometimes would write like about who they're going to marry or write, you know, like hearts, I would write lists of kids' names. Like that was what I was into. I always knew I wanted a big family and I would write it like in different order, boys and girls or twins or, you know, whatever the fantasy was. My whole life, that's what I wanted was to make a family. I don't know. I mean, I can imagine that that my, you know, family configurations and, you know, a child dying and divorce and all these things sort of feeling like they're falling apart could make me want to focus on what I was going to build and create. I think part of it also, certainly in terms of adoption, was that my parents were foster parents to two different girls who were in the system. And I was older than I could remember, you know, 6, 7, 8, and 9, around when the two girls were there at different times. And I remember thinking, how is it possible that kids don't have their own family? And that just, it was just, you know, not okay. And I thought, I want to help to change that.
You, I think it's fair to say you had like a dual mission in adopting Adar. You wanted to adopt because that was your vision of your family. And you also wanted to feel like you were rescuing a child from not having a family. That was the other part of your mission. But when you were filling out the forms to adopt, you had to make some tough choices. Your first was like, what country do you want to adopt from? So you decided Ethiopia. Then you're handed papers where you have to check off what medical conditions are you willing to accept, right? HIV, spina bifida, cleft palate, deaf, blind. And, you know, as a potential adoptive mother, and you're looking at all these conditions and you want to be feeling like you're rescuing somebody. Did you feel like this is a test of how big my heart really is? What went through your mind when you had to decide what to check and what did you check?
Right. We checked only minor conditions as being something we're willing to accept. And it's a hard thing because on one hand, you do know that all of these children need families. Mm-hmm. And on the other hand, you know, there's a limit to what you're willing to do. And I think that's true also in pregnancy, right?
Yes, right.
And
for a lot of women and men,
sure.
You know, for a lot of couples, yeah, and single women, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, we got a mistaken amnio with our youngest bio, and it was clear to me that I would have terminated the pregnancy had that not turned out not to be the case.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So, but here you are, kids who are already there and alive, and it's true. It's a test of how big is your heart. And you have to sort of come to terms with the fact that our hearts are not just completely wide open. And so we made our decisions. I mean, come to find out, later, when we adopted our second son, he was deaf.
He was already deaf, or did was
he
that
was
a condition
going
that
deaf?
Developed?
He was deaf in one ear and limited hearing in the other. And sometimes I look back now and I think, what if I had known that ahead of time? And it's you know, it brings back these old anxieties, like, oh my God, I could never live without him. Like it's terrifying to even imagine not having Zamir. So, you know, I'm grateful I didn't know because I don't know. What would we have done? Would I have said, oh, who needs it? You know, there are plenty of kids.
So how far apart in age are your two sons who are each adopted from Ethiopia?
They're 3 years apart.
Okay. And how old was Zamir, your second son, when you adopted him?
He was 4 years old.
Did you feel comfortable adopting a child who was 4 years old as opposed to somebody, you know, who was still... Who hadn't turned one yet, like your first son.
Right. Yeah, well, that's where we had an opening in our family, right? We had our two youngest were 7 and 3. So I thought that was a good space to fill in. And also because older kids are harder to place, I thought, you know, we're experienced parents now. We could do this.
I think part of the reason why older kids are harder to place is that adoptive parents feel those children are already shaped for better or for worse. And considering the conditions in some of the international orphanages, there's this fear that they've been, you know, not treated very well, not cared for well, and that that will have shaped them in a way that might be damaging in some way. Did you think about that?
I did think about that. And when I was especially worried about that, I would think, if my children were in need of a family, would I want the potential families to making pros and cons lists, or would I want them to just do it? And so I just put it out of my mind, and I thought, whatever is will be, and he's a delight. And now, I mean, it's years later, and I'm much more involved in international adoption and have a much greater understanding of it, and I see the incredible damage that happens to kids in institutions. I mean, really, like, unthinkable damage. But what the research has also shown is that the ability for kids to be rehabilitated is huge. That they can lose an IQ point a month in an institution. It's crazy. Can lose sight because kids' optic nerves aren't stimulated. Like, all of these things that happen to children, these emotional difficulties, these, like, inability to attach, all these things, they're actually all... they could carry it with them and have the way the death of my infant brother I carried with me in many ways, and people will carry things with them. But the ability to love and live fully is really still there. And if you get the right support, the right help, kids really can grow fully.
Susan Silverman, thank you so much. It's been great to talk with you.
Thank you so much.
Susan Silverman's new memoir is called Casting Lots. She spoke with Terry last Monday. Fresh Air Weekend is produced by Heidi Simon. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our technical director and engineer is Audrey Bentham. Our interviews and reviews are produced and edited by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Roberta Shorrock, Anne Marie Baldonado, Sam Brigger, Lauren Krenzel, John Sheehan, Teresa Madden, and Thea Challoner. Molly C.V. Nesper is our associate producer of online media. For Terry Gross, I'm Dave Davies.